91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today's program features Miami Beach Chief of Police Daniel Oates. He was hired for the position in June of 2015. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. His law enforcement career track hasn't been the norm. He was an English major who gained a law degree, then worked as a reporter for the Atlantic City Press. Oates then had a high-level career with the New York City Police Department as head of intelligence for the department. After 20 years in New York, he became chief of Ann Arbor, Michigan, then police chief in Aurora, Colorado. There, he supervised the 2012 investigation of the notorious shooting massacre at a Midnight Century 16 movie showing. So, stay tuned. Chief Daniel Oates is next after NPR and Regional News. And 6 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman with you. This hour we visit with City of Miami Beach Chief of Police Daniel Oates. He's been chief for nearly 3 years. His law enforcement career didn't start in a usual path. He majored in English, worked as a newspaper reporter, then got a law degree.
Chief Oates then went to work for New York City's finest, starting with an Upper East Side beat. He served in New York for 21 years, was promoted to top positions, including the department's head of intelligence.
The Miami Beach Department has nearly 400 officers, 116 civilians, and a budget of about $106 million to provide service to one of the leading tourist attractions in the U.S. And he's with us now in the studio. Welcome, Chief Daniel Oates.
Thank you, Joseph.
Welcome.
Our pleasure.
Good to have you.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Well, I'm going to elaborate a little on what Joe just read about your background. You hold a BA in English from Bucknell University, a Juris Doctor from New York Law School. You're admitted to practice law in Colorado, New York, and New Jersey. You have a Master's degree of Science, a Master's of Science degree from New York University. So, as one who was totally immersed in the world of academia, when and why did you decide to devote your life to law enforcement?
Well, first off, I want to point out that the Bucknell Bisons won the Patriot League, and they play West Virginia in the first round of the NCAAs.
Okay.
In the middle of
Pennsylvania. I just want to get that across.
In the middle of Pennsylvania
there. Right.
So I'm sorry. Well, the question was, what brought me to law enforcement?
From academia.
Well, it's funny. I was working for a magazine in New York, Popular Mechanics Magazine, and looking for something different to do when I heard an ad on the radio circa 1979 that the NYPD was hiring for the first time in 5 years. And I had never once thought, I was 23 years old, I had never once thought about being a police officer. And I was looking for something different to do, and the rest is history.
So no one in your family, no mentor, no contact? You had no contact at all with law enforcement?
Well, I did have an uncle. I had two uncles who were in the NYPD. One left in disgrace in the 1950s. He did something that got him fired. And then I had another uncle who I admired, who was a patrolman for years in Queens. We weren't very close, but that was my only family contact with the NYPD or with policing. And I, like I said, I had never once considered being a cop until I heard that ad on the radio.
And I read that you had been a reporter at the Atlantic City Press and that you covered the police beat.
Right. I went to school in the Watergate era. I graduated in 77.
So you were going to be an investigative reporter.
And that's what I aspired to be. And I had worked for a number of newsrooms.
Bob Woodward.
Yeah. And so I got a full-time job in 77 when I graduated. And that's really what I wanted to be. But things being what they were, we decided to get married. My wife had a quality job in New York, and we felt it'd be easier for me to find a job in Manhattan or New York than her to find a job in South Jersey, hence the move to Manhattan, and I was casting about for a new career after a couple years with Popular Mechanics.
What was it about Popular Mechanic that made you want to get another career?
I wasn't writing. I was a production person.
Oh, okay.
I'm trying to think of the guy who was the keynote of that magazine, kind of a fat guy, how to use towels on cars.
It was an unusual leadership group, readership group, but it was part of the Hearst magazines. I was one flight above Cosmopolitan and Helen Gurley Brown and that whole crew. I was in. It was an interesting time. It was a good exposure to be in publishing for 2.5 years.
So, what do you look for in a police department? I realize why you joined the NYPD. You were there, and you just said you wanted to be in Manhattan. But you've moved a few times. What is it that you look for in a police department before you want to join it?
The arc of my career is that I was a street cop in the 80s when crime was out of control in New York. And there's nothing more fun than being a street cop when crime is out of control. Okay, it's a very exciting and dynamic experience. And I had a great time as a street cop in the 80s. And I had the privilege of reaching the executive rank, the rank of captain, right before Bill Bratton came in 93 and turned the NYPD around. And it's a remarkable government management story about how Bill Bratton turned the NYPD into an effective crime-fighting machine and in the process taught the rest of America American policing how to reduce crime. And I was there for that. And it was incredibly exciting to be a young captain, to be moving through the ranks and getting more and more responsibility and having more of a role in that effort in the 90s. And so I came to aspire to be a police chief. And so the sort of a natural progression that led me here. My first job when I left in 2001 was to be the chief in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I subsequently
Why did you leave?
Because I wanted to be a police chief. I was eligible to retire from the NYPD, and I sought that challenge to be a chief executive and to take over a department that was challenged. And really, there was nothing more than that. And I rather naively now thought, and I think back on it, thought that I had been successful in the NYPD and I could easily translate that success to a troubled police department. And I found that that's actually very, very hard to do. But
you were
chief
of intelligence at the NYPD. What did that entail?
Well, at the time that I ran the intelligence division, which was the 4 years that were the run-up to 2001, the two principal responsibilities were, number one was you were the chief security officer for the city. I was in charge of all elements of security, all security planning for all major events, the protection of every VIP visitor to the city from the President of the United States on down, running security for four UN General Assemblies plus three special sessions.
And you slept at night?
I have to say, as demanding as other jobs have been, that was probably the most intense and demanding moment in my career was those 4 years. And then I was also charged with, when I took over the intelligence division, building a true criminal intelligence function within the department because the police commissioner at the time, Howard Safer, felt that that was lacking. He had come from a career in federal law enforcement, which takes intelligence work in law enforcement much more seriously than municipal police departments do, and he wanted a total reform of the intelligence division. And one of my challenges was to build up that function. For instance, we had a gang problem in New York at the time, and we were in denial about that, and I had a job to fix that and identify what the true gang problem was and produce the information that field commanders could use to reduce the problem. So it was a full-scope job. I had about 450 detectives working for me, and it was very, very exciting. It was a great 4 years.
Did you miss being on the streets?
Well, at that point in your career, you're an executive, and I've always missed not being a street cop. I mean, the last true street cop work I did was in the 80s, the late 80s. And one of the challenges, I think, for a police chief is to stay in touch with what that means and to spend as much time as you can with police officers. And I'm largely a bureaucrat now. I mean, let's face it, I run a government agency. And the challenge for me is to stay in touch with the workaday cop and what he or she does as much as I can. And I try to spend as much time as I can, but it's a challenge.
How ironic that you were head of intelligence for the NYPD and it was just a few short, what was it, a couple of weeks before 9/11
that you left?
Right. I left the NYPD in July, and I didn't start with Ann Arbor until late August. So I was the chief in Ann Arbor about 3 weeks when 9/11 happened.
What a pull that must have been.
Well, everyone has their memories of 9/11, but one of the things that always sticks with me is that I didn't belong in Ann Arbor. I belonged in New York with my colleagues. And of course, every police chief in America recalls that time and the unique demands that were placed on all of us to provide some guidance and reassurance and calm to the communities that we were police chiefs of. And I had that challenge in Ann Arbor.
And Ann Arbor is largely a college town, isn't it?
Yes, it's home of the University of Michigan, 37,000 students. It's a Big Ten town. It's a great town, and about 114,000 residents.
And what were the problems there?
Well, the problems there pre-9/11 and post-9/11 were the typical problems of a college town. All the issues with young men and women who are college age and their indiscretions and poor choices about behavior. We had a somewhat significant crime problem and all the usual service delivery issues. I've been a chief. I've worked in four police departments in four cities in four states, and I tell people policing is about 85% the same across America. The 15% from city to city that might be different can be very different, but about 85% of the challenge of policing is the same no matter where you are. It's all about service delivery. It's about responding to complaints about traffic and about crime and those kinds of things, providing a safety umbrella, working on relationships between police and the community. The 15% that's different can be wildly different from city to city.
After 9/11 in Ann Arbor, part of your duties were to help mitigate the attacks on Muslims after those terrorist attacks. Tell us about that.
Well, I have a great story if you want to get into
it. Of course, we can.
Coming from the NYPD, where commanders are taught that the relationship with religious leaders is essential. That, you know, in policing, if you want to talk about who really knows a community, talk to your cops, talk to your faith leaders, and talk to your teachers. There's no better group of people who know the pulse of a community than those three. So if you're a smart and sensible police commander, one of the things you want to do is get in touch with your faith leaders. So I arrive, and the first week I'm in Ann Arbor, we had a very large mosque in the center of town. And I decided to go visit them for Friday prayers and introduce myself to the leadership at the mosque. And that had never been done before. There'd never been a police officer in the mosque. Now, I'm coming from Brooklyn policing. I was a second in command in Brooklyn. This is what you do normally. This is how you build relationships. So I did that, and I spoke to the congregation, and I had a great visit, and they were very, very appreciative. Well, 2 weeks later, 9/11 happens. And sometime that Tuesday afternoon, it occurred to me to just touch base with the leadership of the mosque and see how they're doing, because they must be very, very upset about everything that's going on. So I call the same people I had met 2 weeks earlier, and they say, "We're so glad you called. We're so worried about the reaction in our community." And you have to understand, there was a significant Muslim population in Ann Arbor, and they were leaders in the community, in every phase of the community. And they said, "Well, we're so concerned that we don't know what to do about this event that we're having a meeting of our elders, our leadership group, in one of our homes this evening." And I said, "Well, can I come?" "Oh, sure, we'd love for you to come, Chief. Can I bring the mayor?" And they said, "Yes." So the mayor and I went that night. And when we met with that leadership, they were as distraught as could be. "This isn't Islam. This isn't us. We repudiate this behavior." I said, "Well, if I can provide you a forum to say that publicly, would you be willing to do so?" And they said, "Of course." So what we did is the very next day, Wednesday afternoon, September 12th, we had a interfaith meeting of all the clergy, the leadership, the faith leaders in Ann Arbor, in City Hall with our elected officials, and just talked about the event. And these leaders in the Muslim community said that in front of everyone and in front of the media. And it was a really important moment. And we didn't have, in the aftermath in Ann Arbor, a single anti-Muslim attack. And we were very, very proud of it. And the mayor, many years later, still touted that as a great success. So that's a good example of how important relationships with faith leaders are with the police.
We're going to talk more about that after this short break. We're speaking with Miami Beach Police Chief Daniel Oates. He was appointed as the 19th chief of the department in June of 2014. We'll be right back.
And we're back with today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, and Police Chief Daniel Oates of Miami Beach. If you'd like to join in with a comment or a question of the chief, you're certainly welcome. 1-800-743-9576 or email. That's radio at WLRN.org, Bonnie.
Chief Oates, I wanted to ask you first, what brought you to Miami Beach?
Well, I had been...
Don't tell me the weather.
Well, the weather in part.
And we've skipped over Aurora, Colorado, yes. But we'll go back.
Well,
we're going back to Aurora. I had been the chief in Aurora for 8.5 years, and there's a shelf life, I think, to be an effective chief, and I was ready for a change and a new challenge. I loved Aurora. It was a fantastic experience for me, tremendous for me and my family, the entire experience in Colorado. But I was restless to do something different, and Miami Beach reached out to me, and there were some unique challenges in Miami Beach that appealed to me. And
the other 15%.
The other 15%. And Florida appealed to me and my wife. We had vacationed regularly with family in Florida for about 25 years, and we had always had in the back of their mind that maybe our last stop would be in Florida and we would retire in Florida. So it all sort of set up well. And then the city manager and the mayor were very convincing in their pitch to me to come and meet the challenges of Miami Beach. So that's how I ended up here.
I just wanted to ask, I mean, we all know about the recent spate of anti-Semitic activity around right. the nation and the world. And since I met you first at a temple on South Beach, I saw you there. And I wanted to ask you if you're concerned what's happened in Miami Beach and if you're concerned about that on Miami Beach.
Well, I've spent a career policing in communities that had significant Jewish populations. And as an enlightened police executive, you have to be very, very sensitive to vulnerable communities. And throughout my career, every place I've worked, there have been periodic threats against Jewish institutions. And so we had recently gone through, and I guess we're still going through, a period where there's these national threats to JCCs, and our JCC has gotten 2 bomb threats. And there appears to be a rise of this kind of behavior. And then, Bonnie, you may recall, about 2 weeks ago, we had an evening where swastikas were carved mm-hmm. on 5 cars. So in that environment, there's a role for the police to provide not only the best security we can to institutions that are threatened and classes of people who are threatened, but also reassurance. So part of that role is occasionally showing up at religious services and meeting with congregants. So on the particular night that I saw you, I had done my part to visit 3 different synagogues, and other members of the department had spread out around town to do the same, just to be present and be a physical message of reassurance to the community. Not that we can prevent every bad act, but that's part of our job, is to send that message and aura of reassurance about security.
Chief, when you took the Miami Beach job, you said that the Miami Beach PD needed image work and leadership. Besides what you just described, how other ways have you provided that?
What is the image?
Yeah.
I have said from the beginning, my sense of the department before I arrived, that to the extent it was perceived to have problems, okay, they were largely problems of image, that the cops are wonderful, and in fact, that is absolutely true. I have absolutely wonderful cops, great cops who work in Miami Beach. But there had been some scandals or perceived scandals, and they largely centered around leadership and accountability. I guess I have a reputation of coming into departments that need some sort of makeover, and I've applied my experience and my skills in the last 3 years to try and do that. And like I said, like I've said from the beginning, it was largely about image. The Miami Beach is fundamentally a great police department. They do incredible things. We're a city with 270 days a year of special events. We have a population of 90,000. On any given day, there's 250,000 people in town. And we go from event to event to event that requires extraordinary demands on the police department. Right now, we're in the second week of spring break. Come out to the beach on any given day, and you'll see the challenges those unique challenges for this period that our cops have. Just my best sense of what needed to be done as an outsider to sort of shake things up a little and instill sort of revive enthusiasm for policing and instill notions of accountability.
There's quite a bit of concern about Ocean Drive, and that it almost takes on a Bourbon Street or a Beale Street feeling of rowdyism and tremendous alcohol abuse and rowdyism. What have you done to make that a little more sane?
Well, the city, not Dan Oates, but the city and our elected leadership have invested a lot of resources in the challenges of Ocean Drive. But, you know, we start with this. Ocean Drive is an iconic, business street that offers a certain kind of nightlife. It's an engine of economic activity for the city. It's a tremendous asset, and it's an exciting and thrilling place. Now, it attracts folks in their 20s and their 30s, to have a good night out, and they come from all over the world to do that. And there's a percentage, perhaps significant percentage, of those folks who will engage in reckless behavior. It wouldn't be the place it is if it didn't also have some people who do that. So there is the presence of excessive drinking. There's the presence of drugs. There's even the presence of prostitution. Those things are present on Ocean Drive and have been, the cops tell me, all their careers. I've only been here 3 years. The challenge for us is trying to control that behavior reasonably with the resources that we have, and also provide a broader aura of protection around Ocean Drive. Now, since I've been here, with the support of the commission, we've dedicated roughly 15 officers full-time to Ocean Drive policing. We've created a full-time homeless outreach team of a sergeant and four officers who deal with homeless issues associated with the entire city, but with a focus on South Beach, and in particular Ocean Drive and those environs, Lummis Park and the beach. We've had any number of plainclothes and undercover initiatives out there, and we've made a lot of arrests, and we've been successful citywide in reducing crime by about 13% in the last 2.5 years, 6% in the last year. So we're having an impact. But as long as Ocean Drive is the destination that it is for so many young people, a portion of which will engage in reckless behavior, we'll continue to have some of those challenges.
There's been talk of earlier alcohol curfews.
There was a public policy debate about changing the – right now, alcohol sales go to 5 a.m. The commission engaged in a public policy debate about curtailing that and making them end at 2 a.m., but that basically – that decision was made not to do that. Instead, the commission, working with the Ocean Drive Association, has come up with a 10-point plan of alternative changes to Ocean Drive that are on their way, and some of them appear to be working. For instance, the way cafes are controlled on the sidewalks and those kinds of things, those are having an impact. Better lighting, all of that.
Will you talk about the jurisdiction of Miami Beach? Because I think some people have the misconception that it's South Beach.
Right. So Miami Beach extends from the southern tip, South Point, up to 87th Terrace. We're about 7 square miles. It's a 7 miles of beach, 63 miles of waterfront with all the islands. We're about 26 islands. And our boundaries are halfway on the causeways, on the MacArthur and the Tuttle. And
so you go halfway to...
Right. The other half is Miami.
And the Venetian.
Right. And the Venetian. And then, of course, like I said, we go all the way 87th Terrace. And then
which is where Surfside starts.
Right. So... sometimes there's some confusion, especially people who don't know that right. Miami Beach is different than Miami. So,
I wanted to ask, you mentioned the homeless and the outreach that you're doing. Has anything improved there? What is happening right
Actually,
now?
The swastika incident was traced back to a homeless individual.
Yes. In fact, the person who we arrested, which is a remarkable piece of detective work by our detectives. The person we arrested in the end was a homeless and troubled individual in his early 60s, I believe, who had also slashed over 100 city bikes. If you know the city bike rental program, we have racks of bicycles all over town, and you can rent a bicycle from point A to point B. He had on 8 different occasions slashed the tires on whole racks of city bikes. And the same evening he did the last act, for which later that day we arrested him for slashing the tires, and we finally solved that case because of really good detective work. We kind of put two and two together that the swastika event had occurred nearby. He was arrested with 2 pairs of scissors on him, and through some really subsequent police work, we were able to tie really good police work, we were able to tie him to the swastika etchings as well. And that was a really important moment when we could go out to our Jewish community and tell them that crime had been solved.
Is there a big criminal element among the homeless on Miami Beach?
Well, there's a hardcore. We do, first of all, Miami Beach provides extraordinary services to homeless folks who need services. We have a homeless outreach team of social services folks, experts. I think it's seven or so full-time professionals who do that work. And I have five police officers, a sergeant, and four who also do outreach. So the city's as invested as can be. And if you want services to get out of homelessness, there's no better place in Miami-Dade County than Miami Beach to ask for and get those services. The challenge we all know that we have is that on any given day when we do our counts, there's somewhere between 150 and 200 homeless on the beach, many of them deliberately and chronically homeless who do not want and reject all efforts at services. Among that population, there's a smaller population of folks who survive by not only appealing for the goodwill of others and donations, you know, panhandling, but also commit petty crimes, largely petty crimes, occasionally serious crimes. So there is a...
And some on the beach itself where there are tourists.
Yes. And so last year, I looked at our statistics, and of the 5,000 or so arrests that we made last year, custodial arrests, roughly 1,500. The number works out to around 26%, whatever the numbers are.
We're homeless.
Self-identify as homeless.
Was the man who did the swastikas, will he be charged with a hate crime?
The way the hate crime statute works in Florida is the police department does not make that decision. We don't charge hate crime. It's a decision that's made by the state attorney's office upon review of the totality of the evidence, and it's an accelerated charge if they find that the facts are there.
We're speaking with Miami Beach Police Chief Daniel Oates, and we're going to take another break. We'll be right back.
And we're back with today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Miami Beach Police Chief Daniel Oates. Again, if you'd like to join in with a comment or a question, you're welcome. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, that's radio@WLRN.org.
Okay, Chief Oates, let's go to Amendment 2. It's in committee. Of course, it had an overwhelming majority. It passed. What does that mean for law enforcement and the whole Miami Beach community?
Especially with your Colorado experience.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Sometimes we get labeled and people make, you know, stereotyped as police officers or police leaders where we stand on an issue. And we take an oath to the democratic process, and the democratic process has spoken, and medicinal marijuana is coming to Florida. So the question is smart implementation. I came from a state. I was there for 9 years as a police leader. I was very involved at the legislature. I was the head of the legislative committee for the Colorado Chiefs during the whole evolution of marijuana in Colorado. And Colorado did not get it right. And today, Colorado is awash in legal and illegal or black market marijuana.
But it's legal there recreationally as well, isn't
correct.
It?
Correct. It evolved to legal recreational, but there were problems when there was only medicinal.
Okay.
So, my sense, and I've been very involved with the Florida police chiefs and advocating, by the way, on behalf of Miami Beach and Miami Beach's perspective on this issue, and it feels like the Florida legislature is going to handle this very differently. So where we stand with Amendment 2 is that there is a bill offered in the House by Senator Bradley. There's a bill in the Senate by Senator Bradley and in the House by Representative Rodriguez. There are two separate bills that are what appears to be the lead enabling legislation on medical marijuana. And there are a whole lot of elements of those bills I could talk about, but essentially they appear to be smart and reasonable efforts to now implement the will of the voters. How this translates into decisions for a municipality like Miami Beach, and Miami Beach has been very, very smart about how it's handling this, and it's considering an ordinance offered by one of our commissioners that will offer very smart and reasonable regulation on a handful of medical marijuana dispensaries in Miami Beach. And so it's...
How will that be determined?
What do you mean?
I mean, who's going to get the dispensaries?
Well, the current model as to who gets the dispensaries is what's called the vertical integration model. There are currently seven under the prior medical marijuana, Charlotte's Web statute, right. There are seven business outfits in the state that have licenses to distribute marijuana. For now, those are the only folks that could actually open a retail medical marijuana dispensary. I believe both of the bills that I described, Senator Bradley's and Representative Rodriguez's, maintain that vertical integration model where the number of outfits that might be authorized by the state over time might grow based on the number of patients, but that would be the model. So it would be the outfit that grows, it's seed to sale, vertical integration would be the – those folks would be the ones who could distribute the marijuana through dispensaries. So for a municipality like Miami Beach, the issue is how many dispensaries, where to place them, zoning issues that a police chief wouldn't be involved in. But I've been asked and consulted about things like security, what we would want in terms mm-hmm. of security cameras, alarms, those kinds of things. And as I said, the commission has before it a very, very smart and sensible bill offered by one of the commissioners that it looks like it will pass, and that will be the local regulation. The issue for Miami Beach and the issue for municipalities is whether or not the state will let us regulate at the local level. Or will they preempt and direct how this business will occur? Our advocacy is please let us decide those issues at the local level. And I've been tasked and gone to Tallahassee twice to represent both Miami Beach and the Florida Chiefs to make that advocacy. Please let us control those kinds of issues at the local level.
As opposed to the state level.
Right.
But on a federal level, it's still illegal. So how does that work?
Well, that's the great experiment. You know, they talk about the states are the engine of experiment in our democracy. That is an unresolved issue. So, for instance, it is still a violation of federal law, banking law, to handle marijuana money.
Right.
So the industry, the legal medical marijuana industry, still fundamentally has a problem with what to do with its money. And banks who handle that money have to worry about being, hauled into federal court for money laundering. So it's a messy situation that is evolving over time. And one police chief doesn't have the answer to those things.
Right.
All of Colorado and California, which are far, far ahead of us in terms of the legal state law medical marijuana, haven't resolved those issues. And now we have a new Justice Department and a new Attorney General, so I think everyone's watching how that's going to be resolved.
The commissioners passed a law a while ago that allows police to issue a $100 ticket to people who have less 20 grams or less of marijuana on them instead of arresting them. Does
yes.
that law complicate matters? Has that complicated matters?
I don't know if it's complicated matters. I think the laws itself...
we're talking about recreational.
Yes,
now.
I understand. The laws itself, evidence of... the evolution of thinking on marijuana in this country and at the local level in Miami Beach. And I believe Miami-Dade passed a similar ordinance. I personally think that we are at a stage similar to the end of Prohibition in the 30s.
Keeping nonviolent offenders out of jail.
Right. And that we are evolving as a society to accept this product as legal. And that evolution will take place over the next decade. And we'll see where we end up.
That must save the city a lot of money.
I don't know that it does. Sometimes there's this misconception out there that police spend a lot of time enforcing marijuana laws.
Well, I'm thinking also of incarcerated.
And I don't think too many people go to jail anymore for
public
mere
defenders.
Possession of marijuana. I don't think it's quite the issue. If you're not close to the criminal justice system, you might think that marijuana enforcement is a bigger issue than it is. I think law enforcement has kind of moved on. It's not like it's a major driving agenda for us.
Let's take a telephone call. We've got Carter. Carter, you're on the air. Hi.
How are you guys today?
Good.
Excellent. So I have a question here. I'm not originally from Miami, but I've been here for the last several years, and it seems to me that the quote-unquote, the Black Beach Weekend, the Memorial Day Weekend celebration that's happened here for quite a number of years.
Urban Beach Week.
Thank you very much. It seems to be policed a bit differently than some of the other celebratory weekends. So what I've seen in the past is, for instance, Washington would be relegated to a one-way traffic strip for a number of miles and forced to have to come around. And just wanted to understand kind of like what's the official policy and why it's different.
Okay.
From other events, right. You're saying.
Well, I've been here for two Memorial Day weekends, and as you may or may not know, that you know there's a history of a whole lot of particular challenges around public safety and policing for Memorial Day weekend for many years. The last couple of years has gone very, very well, but we spend a lot of resources to make sure it goes well, and the two Memorial Day weekends I've been here have been great. They've been great for attendance, lack of incidents, and generally a very pleasant, upbeat, and peaceful time. But it is true that we do have a significant police presence given the history of that particular weekend.
I mean, there have been deaths during that weekend.
There's been quite a few challenges beginning in 2000, and each weekend has gotten better in the last 2 years. I understand mm-hmm. the last 3 or 4 years have gone very, very well. So, yes, it is one of our major events for which there is a significant police presence. Now, if you go out to South Beach this weekend, you'll also see a very, very significant police presence because it's a major, this is one of our high-impact spring break weekends where we'll have a lot of college kids in town. So there are times in the year when we have to gear up with a whole lot of resources.
Carter, does that answer your question?
Well, actually, you know, and first of all, thank you very much. I mean, I believe that you guys have what's often a thankless job, and you guys help keep us safe as citizens and, you know, make sure that we can all enjoy, you know, Miami as much as possible. So first of all, allow me to say that, but as far as numbers are concerned, are you saying that during the Urban Beach Week, there are more numbers than during other weekends, whether it's Pride Festival or Spring Break?
The answer is that the history of Miami Beach in the last 15 years is that is by far and away the biggest weekend in terms of visitors.
Isn't it like a half
challenges.
A million people?
I don't know what the numbers
okay.
are. And the current policing model we have in place was put in place to ensure that we could move people in and out and move the traffic. It's pretty extraordinary, the traffic loop that we have. But if you're coming to the beach, you can get parking, and you can park. The traffic loop encourages you to park your car and enjoy the weekend that way. And so that's part of the reason why we have that particular policing model in place.
Okay, thanks for your
Carter.
Call, Carter.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
We're speaking with Miami Beach Police Chief Daniel Oates. We have our last break, and we'll come right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Police Chief, Miami Beach Police Chief Daniel Oates. I want to ask you, do you mind if we go back to Aurora, Colorado?
Okay.
Okay. So you were the chief of police at the time of the shooting by James Holmes, killed 12 people, injured 70. Was that a transformative experience for you?
Yes, it was a life-altering experience for everybody in Aurora.
Tell me how.
Well, I mean, how do you describe an event like that other than to say that it's life-altering? The entire community was victimized. There wasn't a single day in the aftermath of that event where I didn't speak to someone who knew someone who was in the theater and was directly touched by that event. And this was a large community. Aurora was 350,000 residents. And then, of course, my entire department was victimized. The entire police department, the fire department was victimized. All the first responders were victims. The entire city workforce was victimized. we went through a lot. I mean, the example I give is we were just climbing out of that horror. You know, ours occurred in July, and Sandy Hook occurred in early December. And it was as if the entire city went into a major, major depression again, because we were grieving for what we knew the people in Newtown, Connecticut were going through, because we had just been through it. The trial of the defendant didn't occur until 3 years later, and the cops didn't get to tell their stories because of a gag order. And basically every cop on the witness stand broke down in tears. It was absolutely gut-wrenching, and I think part of the pain for all of us was that we couldn't rest until we got a conviction, and it took 3 years to go to trial, and it was a four-month trial. I tried to watch as much of it as I could on TV. By then, I was here, so I would stream it in the office when I could. But the moment for us of satisfaction, the release came when we convicted him on all counts. I don't know how to describe it other than it was life-altering.
Did it change your views about guns or gun control in any way?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Like I said, we're all sworn to the democratic process. People shouldn't know my view on guns. They should know that I'm a fair and impartial police chief on any of the sensitive issues of the day. They shouldn't know my position on abortion or any of those things. They should know that I and my police department, if there's a protest or a demonstration or a public issue on that, will treat everyone fairly and respect the rule of law and the First Amendment and all of that. So, yes, I have very strong opinions about guns, and I will tell you this. The destruction that was caused by that assault weapon, he fired 65 rounds. He penetrated the wall between Theater 8 and Theater 9. He actually shot three people in Theater 8 because the rounds were so powerful they went through the wall. The destruction that was caused was overwhelming, and I think it's a fair public policy debate to have whether or not those weapons should be in the hands of ordinary citizens or whether or not people who have issues of mental illness or disability should have access to weapons and at what point we declare people to not have access to weapons. All of those are legitimate public policy issues.
Let's take some more calls for Police Chief Daniel Oates, Miami Beach Police Chief. Tim in Hollywood, you're up. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Thank you for your time. And I'd like to know how the police, the Miami Beach Police Department is addressing the issue of the new immigration enforcement laws. Is the Miami Beach Police with a directive or asking for the green card or any sort of legal documents to people traveling in cars as passengers, people walking on the street, or and also I'd like to know what's the chief take on should the police departments enforce immigration laws or act as an immigration officers? Thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
It's a great question. The short answer is, at the local level, local municipal policing, someone's immigration status should be an irrelevance to what we do. We have an obligation to provide police services to anybody that comes within our jurisdiction, within anyone we have contact with.
So you don't ask for any papers in routine traffic stops?
And the answer is no, we don't. And there's a common misconception out there that police have some role in immigration enforcement. We have no jurisdiction and no authority to enforce federal immigration law. The real issue is, if at some point while you're in police custody, the local police department finds out that you are undocumented, which is very hard to do. There's another common misconception out there that at the local policing level, there's a button we can push, there's a computer we can query, and lo and behold, we're going to be told someone's immigration status. Figuring out someone's immigration status is actually extremely hard to do. And you can make an inquiry of ICE, and it can take hours for them to get back to you to tell you someone's immigration status.
Why would a police officer want to make an inquiry of ICE?
It's extremely rare. We might have a hardened criminal, and we might want to know for that reason. So what the real public policy issue is this, okay? If at some point you become aware of someone's immigration status and that the federal government wants you to hold that person so that they can come and take him away in a couple hours, what's your authority to hold them? Now, in Miami Beach, as a practical matter, we're not going to know that almost all the time because we don't run a jail. Within hours of an arrest, we take someone to the county jail. It's at the county jail that biometric fingerprint will end up being in the hands of the feds, and the feds will look at it and say, that's probably Dan Oates, and Dan Oates is undocumented, and he's got a criminal history, and we want to get our hands on him. But when that phone call comes in, the real public policy issue is, does the local police department hold that person for the feds if that person is otherwise ready to be released because he made bond, because his case has been adjudicated to time served, because he's been released on his recognizance, do you hold on to him? That's the public policy issue. Okay, now I came from, it's not an issue in Miami Beach. The last place I worked, very, very immigrant-rich community, okay, with 350,000 residents and a significant presence of undocumented immigrants, largely from Mexico, okay, that was an issue. As a police department, we didn't want people fleeing us, getting in a car accident, fleeing the scene because they were afraid that if the police showed up, they'd be deported. Or not, more importantly, not cooperating with the police when they're the witness or victim of a crime.
Did it all figure in your leaving Aurora?
No, I left Aurora because in the evolution of my career, it was time to leave Aurora. Aurora was a wonderful community, but it had a lot of these challenges. Aurora had relatively inexpensive multifamily housing, and therefore was a place that the State Department relocated a lot of refugees. Aurora was a community full of refugees from all over Africa and Asia, in addition to a significant immigration challenge. And we were adamant, and my successor is adamant in Aurora, that we did not want to know someone's – we didn't care about someone's immigration status. Trust us and let us deliver the services we need to deliver. Here in Miami Beach, it's a different story because we're not going to know someone's immigration status. We're simply not going to know. We're not going to have it confirmed before they're in the jail if they're under arrest. And at that point, it's the county's challenge to figure all that out. And it's a significant public policy question, especially when you have the federal government threatening that funding streams may not be available to you. But I submit, I don't know what the legal basis is to hold someone who is otherwise ready to be released because they've paid their bond, they've been adjudicated, you know, released on their own recognizance. You know, what's the basis to hold them for 6 hours for the feds to come and pick them up?
What's the biggest crime problem on Miami Beach?
Like the other communities I've worked in, the biggest, overwhelming almost every city in America, the biggest problem is going to be theft. We have a particular problem with car burglaries, car break-ins. It's 11% of all our crime is car break-ins. We have a challenge with beach thefts. People think that it's, you know, you're on vacation, you let your guard down, you're on the beach, and you hide your wallet under a towel, your iPhone under a towel. And we have, you know, our beaches are very large, very, very heavily populated, and there's some folks who prey on people who do those kinds of things. We do have a bit of a burglary problem, but our biggest problems are thefts.
What about big time drug activity?
Of course,
compared to the cocaine cowboy days.
But my understanding is when I talk to cops who've been around in those days, we have nowhere near that degree of problem. Now.
We talked about the anti-Semitic outlash. I'm wondering about racism. Either is that an ongoing concern for you in the department or among in the community?
Well, obviously, it's an ongoing concern, and it should be for any enlightened police department in America. But the biggest issues around intolerance have been the occasional threats to Jewish institutions and the occasional swastikas. We also have a significant gay population in Miami Beach, and we have to be very sensitive to their particular concerns as well.
We want to thank Miami Beach Police Chief Daniel Oates. He's been police chief since 2014. He's also an attorney, among many other things. And we really thank you for being with us today.
Indeed, well, thank you, Bonnie. Joe, it was great.
Stay safe. Be well.
And apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air, including James and Rick. We hope you've enjoyed today's edition. It was produced by Polly Landis, engineering by online director Jason Zebka. Richard Ives is lead producer. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade School Board meeting. Bonnie and I return Thursday with a program which begins with Melissa Maker, author of Clean My Space. Also, Linda Gassenheimer's Food and Dining with her annual St. Patrick's Day celebration. Remember, as always, we have free audio archives of this and other programs at our website. That's WLRN.org. Also, check out the Topical Currents Facebook page, as well as the iTunes podcast. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.